Macmillan Audio presents El Jefe by Alan Fuhr. Narrated for you by Tim Andres Pabon. Joaquin was what he is and will be, a fugitive from justice, the lord of the mountain, and a boss in the city. Los Canelos de Durango, the lord of the mountains. Act 1. Server Jack. Nearly all crimes go unpunished in Mexico. Field of battle, Sergio González Rodríguez. 1. The Geek Squad Guy. June 2009 through February 2010. It came in off the street one day. A tip, a lead, a rumor, whatever you cared to call it, it was one of the strangest things they had heard in their careers. Chapo Guzman, the world-famous drug lord, had hired a young IT guy, and the kid had built him a sophisticated system of high-end cell phones and secret servers, all of it ingeniously encrypted. The unconfirmed report, perhaps that was the best way to describe it, had arrived that Friday in June 2009. When a tipster walked into the lobby of the FBI's Field Division office in New York. After his story had been vetted downstairs, it made its way up 7 flights of stairs and landed with a curious thud among the crowded cubicles of C-23, the Latin American drug squad. For more than 30 years, the elite team of agents and their bosses had hunted some of the drug trade's biggest criminals, and while tall tales of their antics circulated constantly through its squad room near the courts in Lower Manhattan, no one in the unit knew what to make of this one. The tipster's account seemed credible enough, but it was sorely lacking details. The only facts he had offered on the young technician were a first name, Christian, and that he was from Medellin, Colombia. All sorts of kooks, spouting all sorts of nonsense, showed up all the time at FBI facilities, claiming they had inside information on the Kennedy killing or knew someone who knew someone who knew where Jimmy Hoffa was. In what were still the early days of internet telephony, it seemed a bit far-fetched that a 20-something hacker had reached a deal with the world's most wanted fugitive and furnished him in hiding with a private form of Skype. As alluring as it sounded, it was just the sort of thing that would probably turn out to be a myth. In the middle of a drug war, chasing myths was not enough to send C-23 into the field. Reality was keeping the unit busy on its own. 3 years after Mexico had launched a crusade against its brutal cartel kingpins, the country had erupted into incomparable violence, and much of the chaos had rolled downhill into American investigative files. Just that winter, a psychopath who called himself the Stewmaker had been caught near Tijuana after having boiled 300 bodies down to renderings in caustic vats of acid. 2 weeks later, a retired Mexican general was murdered in Cancun, his kneecaps shattered, and his corpse propped up behind the steering wheel of a pickup truck abandoned on a highway. Since late 2006, the country's 7 drug clans had all been at war with one another, or the government, or sometimes both at once, and 10,000 people had already lost their lives. C-23 and other U.S. law enforcement agencies pitched in when they could, opening cases and offering intelligence to their counterparts in Mexico, but in the past several months, conditions at the border had only gotten worse and had metastasized from an ordinary security emergency into something that resembled a full-scale insurrection. From the American point of view, the Sisyphean struggle to end the bloodshed and to stem the flow of drugs heading north seemed increasingly impossible, despite the constant seizures, the federal indictments, and the helicopter gunships sent as foreign aid. In this target-rich environment, Chapo Guzman was an interesting case. While he was neither the wealthiest nor the most sadistic trafficker in Mexico, he was by a matter of degree the most illustrious. His famous alias, El Chapo, often rendered shorty but more accurately a reference to his squat, stocky frame, was globally familiar, with a recognition level that rivaled that of movie stars and presidents. Not since Pablo Escobar had ruled over Colombia had La Pista Secreta, the secret path of the narcotics business, seen a figure who was both a major criminal and a mass celebrity. For nearly 20 years, Guzman had been at the center of the drug trade, involved in some of its best-known capers and disasters. In 1993, in his earliest brush with fame, he was sent to jail in Mexico for the murder of a Roman Catholic cardinal, Juan Jesus Posadas Ocampo, whose daylight killing at the Guadalajara airport introduced the world to the threat presented by Mexican cartels. 8 years later, in a move that earned him full folkloric status, Guzman had escaped from prison, slipping out in a laundry cart after paying off his jailers. Ever since, he had been on the run, moving back and forth among a half dozen hideouts deep in the Sierra Madre Mountains in the Mexican state of Sinaloa. Though he lived like an outlaw, he was treated like a king, loved by some, feared by many, and inarguably one of the most powerful men in Mexico. A single word from him, from one of his mountain dens, could set in motion tractor trailers in Nogales, planes in Cartagena, and merchant freighters in Colón. At 52, an improbable age in an industry that did not promote longevity, Guzman had reached the height of his career, running his business freely and warring against his rivals, all while playing cat and mouse with those among the Mexican authorities who weren't on his payroll. While the American government was after him as well, a contrarian consensus had emerged in parts of Washington that at least he was contained in the Sierras, where he was spending exorbitant sums on his security and could not engage in the same bloody havoc that emergent mafias like the Zetas or La Familia Michoacan had recently been wreaking in the lowlands. It was also the case that no one, not the FBI, the DEA, nor their cousins in the intelligence community, had ever mounted a successful capture operation in the rugged region he had fled to. In the past 2 years alone, a panoply of American agencies had helped arrest Otto Herrera, Guzman's connection to Colombia's cartels, Juan Carlos Ramirez, one of his top suppliers, and Jesus El Rey Zambada, the brother of El Mayo Zambada, his most important partner. The heir to Guzman's throne, Mayo's son, Vicente, was in jail in Mexico City, and Pedro and Margarito Flores, the twin brothers who had handled much of his American distribution, were about to start recording him for U.S. drug officials. By mid-2009, Guzman himself was already under indictment in San Diego and Tucson and would soon face further charges in Brooklyn and Chicago. But after all of this, countless hours of investigative and prosecutorial effort, he had never spent a single day in an American court of law. That was why C-23's new lead couldn't be discounted, as crazy as it sounded. The possibilities it promised were simply too enticing. It stood to reason that a man in Guzman's position, on the lam, with far-flung operatives around the globe, would at least want a means of sending and receiving secret messages. Imagine the windfall if the drug squad in New York could hack into the system. That is, if it actually existed. While many of his co-workers shrugged at the story of the mythic cell phone system, treating it like a piece of science fiction, Special Agent Robert Patash raised his hand and volunteered to run the rumor down. As the rookie in the unit, he had little else to do. Patash had joined C-23 only the year before, and while he was as eager as anyone to succeed, he was still finding his feet among his older, more seasoned peers. One of those anomalies who came to law enforcement late in life, Patash had attended the FBI's academy in Quantico just before his 37th birthday, the outside age for new recruits. For a federal agent, his background was unusual. Trained as a mechanical engineer, Patash had spent 15 years of well-paid boredom in the private sector, designing robots and lasers, before he realized that what he really wanted to do was put together criminal cases, not expensive widgets. The son of a toolmaker from Connecticut, he had always been something of a tinkerer. Even approaching 40, he often still thought about himself as the handy little kid who built the neighborhood treehouse every summer and spent all winter working on a soapbox car in his garage. Patash had never handled a cartel case before, but knowing of his technical bent His bosses at C-23 had invited him to sit in on the interview with the tantalizing tipster. He left the conversation convinced there was something there, and did not get much resistance from the squad when he stepped forward to investigate it further. Many of the unit's top agents didn't want the job, which, by the looks of it, was going to require studying encryption and reading up on arcane subjects like voice-over internet protocol. It was, to say the least, not the typical drug cop stuff of busting bad guys or grabbing kilos off the street. When you got down to it, it was more or less nerd work. But that was Patash's lane. Joining him in his new assignment was his partner, Stephen Marston. Marston was 8 times as experienced as Patash, and nearly twice as tall. An agent cut from the classic mold, big, broad-shouldered, stolid, methodical. Marston, a New Yorker, had been at C-23 for much of the decade. In his own time in the unit, he had mostly focused on Colombians, among them the remnants of the cocaine cowboys from Medellin and Cali, who had since the 1980s supplied cocaine to Mexican smugglers like Guzman, who worked along the border. While Marston didn't know much about technology, his computer degree from 1993 was obsolete, he did know quite a bit about investigating drug cartels, and something in the tipster's report had caught his eye. Under questioning, the tipster had explained that shortly before the young technician, Christian, had gone to work for Guzman, he had built a beta version of his system for another trafficking group, the Cifuentes family, one of Colombia's stealthiest and most successful smuggling organizations. Known as the Invisible Clan for their ability to work beneath the radar, the Cifuenteses were, like Christian, based in Medellin. The family had a long and tangled history with Guzman and had for years been shipping him their product in everything from King Commander turboprops to long-range shark and tuna boats. Marston knew that the tipster's story might have had a few implausible details, but he recognized its basic inner logic. If some of the Cifuenteses had acquired a new technology, it would certainly be reasonable to think that they had passed it on, through the man who had developed it, to their longtime friend and ally. Meticulous as always, Marston was not about to raise an alarm or his boss's expectations without first thoroughly confirming the account. In the FBI, if you were smart, you always promised less than you delivered. As he and Patash started on the case, Marston decided that he needed proof of concept, some hard evidence that the secret system was more than just a pipe dream. What he really needed, when he thought about it further, was one of the damned phones. They started with their colleagues in Colombia. After squeezing the tipster for all that he was worth, Marston and Patash decided to run his story past the experts on the ground, the FBI's legal attaché team and their DEA equivalents in Bogotá. They arranged a call with the embassy, and to their surprise, when they mentioned Christian's name, everyone seemed to know who they were talking about. A young technician, Christian Rodriguez, they were told, ran a small business in Medellin, repairing computers and setting up communications networks. Rodriguez was also known to dabble from time to time in the city's black hat hacking scene. Though there wasn't much in the way of solid proof, the agents in Bogotá were confident it had to be their man. Signing off, Marston and Patash dwelled on their discovery, the young kid that Chapo Guzman had brought in as his infotech consultant appeared to have a day job as Medellin's Geek Squad guy. Once they had his full name and birth date, it was pretty much a routine, full-court press, working with their counterparts in Bogotá. Marston and Patash put together a profile, running down and identifying anyone they could find with a connection to Rodriguez. Family members, old friends, lovers, neighbors, acquaintances, and colleagues. Medellin's tech world at the time wasn't like New York's or San Francisco's, with tens of thousands of salaried employees and large conglomerates lording it over a field of plucky startups. The scene down there was small and fragmented, largely based on consulting gigs and casual relationships. Some of those relationships, given the city's history with crime, seemed to straddle the line between legal commerce and far less sanctioned ways of making money. The agents in New York were looking for an in, someone who knew the young technician and might be persuaded to give them information. Within a month of developing their dossier, they settled on a target, another young man on the make, one who had done business with Rodriguez in the past. Flying down to Medellin to meet him that summer, they used their charms and a quantity of taxpayer dollars to convince him to cooperate. The associate, as they came to call this second source, pulled off a triumph by September. He scared up one of Rodriguez's encrypted phones. It was an E-series Nokia with a dark gray case, a color screen, and a simple little keypad. Though it didn't look like much, Marston and Patash knew it was top of the line. The E71 was one of the earliest smartphones on the market. Not exactly NASA-level tech, but not a flip phone either, and it wasn't cheap. When Marston and Patash Googled the device, they found it was selling for $700, nearly twice as much as their government-issue BlackBerries. One thing was for certain, there weren't a whole lot of people walking around with an E71 in the early fall of 2009. The associate was coy as to how he had procured the device, but Marston and Patash weren't too particular. They had what they were after, and had come to learn that in a cocaine capital like Medellin, it was often the case that the objects people handled, like the gossip they provided, moved in mysterious ways. Things in Medellin could and did suddenly appear, sometimes without much explanation. Granted, of course, that the terms of the agreement and the price were right. Back stateside, they took their prize to the FBI's engineering research facility in Virginia. The giant complex, known as ERF, was where the Bureau's best eggheads worked their magic. Packet sniffing, passcode breaking, systems analysis, and various other digital dark arts. The imposing structure on the agency's training grounds in Quantico all but quivered with the might and weight of the government. Pulling up outside, Marston and Patash were confident that the brains at ERF would take one look at Rodriguez's device and it would wither beneath their gaze, revealing all its secrets. But as soon as they walked in, the techs approached them as though they were carrying a dirty bomb. Grabbing the phone from the agent's hands, they shoved it into a Faraday bag and quickly locked the seal. Patash was taken aback. Perhaps he should have realized that if they were trying to study Guzman's phone, the phone might be trying to study them as well. In the end, that wasn't the case. The phone was dormant and not emitting signals, but it was instructive to have learned that the kingpin's little Nokia could send a message to its master if it wanted. "Hey, boss, the gringos have me at a hacking lab in Quantico." That, however, was the only thing they learned that afternoon. After running through a suite of tests, the techs came back and said, "Sorry, guys, this one can't be cracked." Marston and Patash couldn't believe it. Even ERF, with all of its diagnostic firepower, wasn't able to get into the thing. It was, if nothing else, persuasive verification of Christian Rodriguez's tradecraft. Their proof of concept was looking more intriguing and spookier by the day. They talked about it later, driving home. The way the techs had explained it, there were several different overlapping problems. Among the most important was that Rodriguez's phone was using an early form of point-to-point encryption. Point-to-point encryption is a defensive technology that requires two codes. One code scrambles messages and prepares them for delivery. The second receives the messages and puts them back together. Without both codes, any communication captured as it passes in between two phones, law enforcement's typical means of interception, would come out looking like a bunch of garbled nonsense. Patash in particular understood that this type of encryption was the real deal, the gold standard of information security. It meant that Guzman's Nokias could talk to one another completely in the dark. The second problem was the underlying hardware. The Bureau's techs had quickly determined that the E71 wasn't running off of normal commercial infrastructure, a cellular service, for example, owned by a standard provider like AT&T or Verizon. It was instead running off the internet on its own private server. And the server wasn't only private. It was funky and furtive, and seemed to be forever moving around. But Tash had been hoping that ERF could have tracked the system's IP address back to a tech firm in Colombia and told him that Rodriguez was managing his server operation on his lunch break from a secret little closet in the basement. If that had been the case, it would have been easy. The FBI could prevail on the company to do the right thing. If the bosses didn't comply, agents could simply serve a warrant. But there was no company and no secret closet. When the techs at ERF dug into the server's address, it was 15 shades of weird. They could see its identifying digits, number dot number, but they couldn't determine its location, which appeared to have been anonymized and was skipping across the globe. This sort of thing was not mainstream technology in 2009. It was far more sophisticated than anyone suspected. Batash was as frustrated as he was impressed. You couldn't serve a warrant on an anonymous location. It was almost like a snitch had told him that a ton of pure cocaine was sitting in a warehouse somewhere ready for the taking, then handed him a battering ram to break through the door. The problem was, where was the door? No one knew. Whoever had built this thing, he thought, was a serious MIT-level systems engineer. An engineer himself, Patash felt like a kindergartner holding it in his hands. They became obsessed with the kid. They couldn't stop talking about him, thinking about him, trying to figure out what made him tick. It was obvious to both of them that he was some sort of prodigy. And yet, for a techie, Rodriguez had hardly left behind a digital trail. Aside from his ties to the Cifuentes family, he didn't seem to have much of a resume or client list for them to follow either. The associate helped fill in some details. In their conversations and frequent trips to see him, the associate told the agents that Rodriguez wasn't a lawbreaker by nature. He was simply trying to hustle his way through a criminal economy in which some of the people who signed up for his services were not exactly what they claimed to be. Whatever he was, investigating the mystery of the young technician had started to develop the itch of an addiction. The agents' wives began to joke that they were spending more time with one another than with anyone else. When the joke aged, there was a new joke. When they threw their husbands out, the wives complained, Marston and Patash would no doubt find a place together and probably be happier working around the clock. It didn't help that by the end of the year, they decided that they needed to be on the ground in Colombia. In mid-December 2009, a few months into what the New York office was now calling Operation Server Jack, they booked a flight to Bogota and flew down with a PowerPoint on everything they knew about their case. Arriving at the embassy, they shook their colleagues' hands and set up shop. But when they flashed their slides of Guzman, Christian, and the secret system, it provoked the same confused looks that the initial tip had gotten in the squad room in New York. Everyone was interested, of course. Computers? Cool. But no one really got it. So wait a minute, Marston and Patash were asked. It's not a landline, but it's not a cell phone either? What the heck is it? How do they pay their monthly bill? What the team in Bogota wanted to discuss was drugs, and not just any drugs, specifically the drugs being sold by the Cifuentes organization. Marston and Patash weren't the only agents with hooks into the family. The DEA had been on them for months. It was explained to the visitors that two investigations were currently underway in Miami and New York, the latter being fed by a wiretap that the Colombians were running with the U.S. Embassy's assistance. The tap, which had been in place for the past 2 years, was almost unimaginably vast. Hundreds of phones were being monitored, and in terms of raw numbers, the intercepts were already in the neighborhood of 15, 16,000. Nearly every member of the sprawling clan, the matriarch, Carlina, her 9 adult children, and God knew how many nieces and nephews were under surveillance. The Cifuentes family could barely order Chinese food without the embassy knowing if they had gotten white rice or brown rice in the bag. Which meant, of course, that the DEA guys liked to talk about the family, and did. Marston and Patash didn't mind. The history of the Cifuentes organization was horribly confusing, a dense web of shifting alliances and violent executions. but it was useful, if only to put Christian into context. It was interesting to learn that after starting out as small-time smugglers who trafficked cigarettes and whiskey through the port in Medellin, the family had clawed its way to power, mainly by hedging bets and striking up strategic ties with most of Colombia's larger, stronger crime groups. Fernando Cifuentes, the oldest brother in the clan, had once served as a bodyguard for Efraín Hernández, a capo in the North Valley drug cartel. The second brother, Pacho, had gone to work for Pablo Escobar, serving as a pilot. After a stint in Mexico working with Mayo Zambada, Chapo Guzman's partner, a third Cifuentes brother, Jorge Milton, had traveled to Texas and built a brisk business bringing coke into the state. Only Alex Cifuentes, the baby of the family, had failed to uphold its famous name. Plagued by addiction and aggression, Alex had bounced around for years working for his brothers in subordinate positions, all while drinking prodigiously and raising hell, beating up taxi drivers and setting fire to nightclubs. Even into his 30s, Alex had remained a kind of dilettante, happy to spend his family's fortune, but never quite able to hold a steady job. It was in the early 2000s, Marston and Batash were told, that the Cifuenteses had embarked on their partnership with Guzman. At the time, the kingpin was just beginning to rebuild his business after breaking out of prison in 2001. Pacho Cifuentes had by that point taken control of his family's own business after Fernando had been killed and found himself in charge of an illegal empire cloaked by a series of quasi-licit holdings in real estate, cattle ranches, airlines, construction firms, and emerald mines. Pacho and Guzman, sensing an opportunity, came to an arrangement. Pacho agreed to fly cocaine from one of his private airstrips and a hangar at the Medellin airport into western Mexico on one of Guzman's latest acquisitions, a small fleet of carbon fiber airplanes that could, or so the kingpin said, pass through radar undetected. When the deal turned out to be a huge success, others soon followed, and Pacho brought Jorge and Alex into Guzman's orbit. It was a testament to how enmeshed they all became that within a few years, their sister Dolly also started to work with Guzman. There was one last piece to this story, and it was directly relevant to the New York agent's case. In April 2007, Pacho had himself been killed. There had long been rumors that he was an American informant, and apparently believing they were true, Colombia's most feared cartel, the Oficina de Envigado, sent a hit team disguised as policemen to murder him at his ranch near Medellin. The assassination devastated the younger Cifuentes brothers, and not just for the usual reasons. After Pacho's death, Jorge and Alex discovered that he owed as much as $10 million to Guzman and other top drug lords in the region. Now the leader of his family, Jorge flew to Mexico and reached his own arrangement with the kingpin. Fearing for his safety in Colombia, he announced he was moving down to Ecuador and proposed to pay off Pacho's debt by sending cocaine to Sinaloa from a series of the country's western seaports. In setting up the project, Jorge spared no expense. He conspired to have the drugs protected by a corrupt Ecuadorian army officer and bribed the Navy for the latest information on prowling American ships. To further indemnify his scheme, Jorge made a personal gesture. He suggested sending Alex, who had just gotten sober, to live with Guzman in the mountains as a kind of human collateral. Jorge's deal, with its insulating layers of insurance and corruption, appealed to the kingpin, and he took it. All this history finally closed the circle. Marston and Patash already knew by then how Christian Rodriguez had made his way to the Cifuentes family. Now they understood how Jorge and Alex had made their way to Guzman. As the crash course came to an end, one of the DEA guys had a question. It concerned their own wiretap. There were moments on the wire, he said, when one Cifuentes would suddenly tell another, "Hey, let's continue this discussion on the spark." The phrase itself was strange enough, but even stranger, it seemed to be used only when the intercepts were getting good and sensitive subjects were about to come up. The DEA was working on a theory that the Spark was some sort of meeting place, a hideout, or a soundproof chamber the family would retreat to for private conversations, but they didn't really know. Marston and Patash knew, or at least they had a guess. The Spark, they told their colleagues in Bogota, was probably the forerunner to Guzman's system that their tipster had mentioned, the beta version that Rodriguez had built for the Cifuentes clan. You could all but see the investigative synapses firing in the room. The Cifuentes family had two communication systems, one of them existing in the open light of day, the DEA had been monitoring for months. But the other system, secret like Guzman's was hidden in the dark. Poor bastards, Patash thought. It was a bit like living in a house for 30 years and then one morning discovering a door in the basement leading to a whole new house beneath it. He pitied them a little, if only because he recognized the feeling. Once it had a name, the DEA wanted access to the Spark, but at least so far, the Kingpin's similar system had stumped the finest minds the FBI had thrown at it. In the absence of a technical solution, and there didn't seem to be one yet, getting into either secret system was going to require getting to Rodriguez. From the outset of Operation Server Jack, Marston and Patash had debated the idea of approaching the young Colombian. In one of their recent meetings with the associate, their source had told them that even though Rodriguez was making loads of money, he was petrified on an almost daily basis to be working for Chapo Guzman. While that made him susceptible to an approach, which was clearly an advantage, it also made him skittish, which was not. Talking it over with their bosses in New York, Marston and Patash decided that they needed to be careful. They would get only one chance to flip Rodriguez. If they made a play for him and the kid said no, Operation Server Jack was almost certainly over. In the best-case scenario, the young technician would simply disappear, but in the worst, he would shut the system down. There was, however, another option, an undercover sting. When Marston and Patash came back from Colombia, they holed up in the squad room trying to game it out. The goal, of course, was leverage, to catch Rodriguez selling his technology to a criminal, preferably on camera. While the obvious choice was to run a customer against him, posing as a member of a Mexican cartel, no one in the unit was persuaded that was viable. If Christian Rodriguez valued his life, even in the slightest, he would never offer his services to anyone who could be perceived as Guzman's competition. An Italian undercover wasn't much better, they decided. Everyone agreed that the mafia gambit was a bit played out. Then it came to them. Marston had an old friend in the Bureau's local Russian squad. A Russian might work. They weren't like Mexicans. A Russian organization wouldn't want to bring a techie deep into their business and lock him in with a long-term contract or a loyalty oath. Russians were independent. They would want to do things simply, buy a product at a reasonable price, learn how to use it, then run it by themselves. When Marston called his friend, the friend said he knew someone who might be good for them. A real Russian gangster who was already in custody, working off the sentence of his own federal charge. If the Russian was as good as the friend was saying, they might be able to use the associate to nudge Rodriguez into meeting him. A few days later, Marston and Patash went to meet their undercover. The Russian, they discovered, was a large, imposing man with a black leather jacket, a hardcore scowl, and a heavy Slavic accent. He was more than good. He was perfect. 2. Up in the mountains. December 2008 through February 2010. Christian Rodriguez would not have been surprised when he received a phone call from his countryman, Alex Cifuentes, as Christmas approached in late 2008. Rodriguez had, after all, just completed a special project for the well-known trafficker and two of his closest siblings. A few months earlier, Rodriguez had gone to visit Dolly Cifuentes, Alex's older sister, at her rose-filled home in Medellin, to discuss the encrypted communications system that she and her brothers needed to conduct the more clandestine aspects of their business. Rodriguez, new to the job of serving criminals, came up with some ideas, and they were good enough ideas that Dolly suggested running them past her brother Jorge, who was down in Ecuador working on the family's latest venture. Rodriguez went to Ecuador, met with Jorge, and after he returned, presented his new clients with a handcrafted product, a firewalled cell phone system that ran on its own private network and allowed its users to exchange protected texts. Though Rodriguez had just turned 21, he looked much younger. He was, for one thing, conspicuously short, not much more than 5'4", and his wan skin, pudgy cheeks, and little hacker's belly betrayed him as the kind of man who had spent his life in front of screens. Long drawn to the shadows of the digital world, Rodriguez had gone to school for systems engineering, but dropped out after only 3 semesters to launch a cybersecurity firm. The business, for the most part, was legitimate. Web design, tech support, network administration. Though on occasion, to make ends meet, he did admittedly accept assignments from customers whose own work was somewhat less than lawful. It was the sort of thing that was perhaps bound to happen in a town like Medellin. Alex Cifuentes had called that winter on behalf of such a customer, his own new employer, the kingpin Chapo Guzman. In late 2007, Alex had been sent into the Sinaloan Mountains by his older brother Jorge, and ever since, he had been working as Guzman's personal secretary, looking after almost every aspect of an expansive criminal empire. The task of serving as the right-hand man to a drug lord with a multi-billion dollar bottom line and employees everywhere from Chicago to the South China Sea could at times be maddening. One day, it might mean dealing with a lost load of coca paste. The next, attending to the purchase of a crate of RPGs. When Alex took the position to secure his family's business with the kingpin, he was still recovering from a debilitating surgery brought on by the ravages of alcohol. Gastric fluids leaking from his stomach had turned into a fistula and resulted in a near-fatal case of pancreatitis. In his weakened state, Alex was nonetheless placed in charge of paying Guzman's gunmen, wrangling his pilots, managing his airstrips, overseeing his motor pool, and supervising the kaleidoscopic churn of coke deals, pot deals, and heroin deals that packed his busy schedule each day. While the kingpin's nights in the mountains could often be a blur of mistresses and whiskey, the rush began at noon when he woke up to take his morning meal. There was a small shack near his cabin where 2 maids cooked him breakfast on an old gas stove. As soon as he sat to eat, Alex or a colleague would be called upon to deliver an intelligence report. Had the troops been active at their base that day? Were any of his enemies on the move? After the briefing came, his list of daily messages, perhaps one of his sons had called or his plaza boss in Mazatlan. From his simple kitchen table, Guzman would issue orders for a cash drop in Los Angeles or a checkup on production at his meth labs in Jalisco. Alex was expected to take down these instructions in a notepad, but it was only after the kingpin finished his meal that he began to work in earnest. Then he would pick up his favorite means of communication, a long-range cordless phone, and step outside beneath the high Sierra pines to return his calls while strolling under the trees. When Alex first arrived in the mountains, Guzman had been living there for the better part of a decade. Born in the Sierras, in the village of La Tuna, the kingpin knew firsthand the advantages they offered to a fugitive. The local roads, bent with rocky switchbacks, were perfect ambush country and were easy to defend against attack. Much of the rough terrain could be approached only by foot or on off-road vehicles and was more or less impassable to military convoys. Snaking south through Sonora, Sinaloa, and Durango, the ancient Sierra Madres had always been a sanctuary for renegades, and the region's austere landscape of scrub and sky had produced a culture of wary insularity. In the small towns clinging to the hillsides, the residents were stubborn, independent, and suspicious of the government. Time and experience had taught them not only to distrust the state, but to turn a blind eye to the dusty trucks of outlaws bouncing up the twisting mountain passes. Guzman knew he could rely on the loyalty of their terror. With families of their own to protect, they would likely keep their mouths shut if they saw him, and might even tip him off to approaching troops, or hide him in a basement if he found himself in need. But after 6 years of hard and constant use, many of Guzman's mountaintop retreats were in a state of disrepair. Not that they had been much to begin with. Spartanly equipped with wood plank huts, cheap plastic furniture, and power systems running off of used car batteries, the rustic compounds had the temporary, makeshift look of logging camps. Blackened cookware hung from nails on the sides of moldy buildings, and perishable rations were left outside to rot. Guzman's 30-man security team, filthy, rowdy cells of former soldiers, slept on the floor in ramshackle barracks and were provisioned once a month by plane loads of bullets, beans, and tortillas flown in from below. Some of the encampments had small bucolic touches, fruit trees in the yard, dance palapas, Cornish hens, but they were mostly a disaster. It was not at all what Alex Cifuentes, an art collector and a connoisseur of thousand-count sheets, had been accustomed to. Within a few months of taking his new job, he began to make improvements, bringing in refrigerators, washer-dryers, and plasma screen TVs. The internet service in the mountains was particularly bad, generally running off of shoddy rooftop satellite antennae that often failed in the torrential monsoon rains that blew through every summer. For a man who was obsessed with technology and often kept 10 different sets of his cordless phones on hand, it was all but inconceivable that Guzman had such a glaring gap in his communication system. But Alex had decided to improve that, too, which is why he had called Christian Rodriguez. It wasn't easy getting to the mountains. Most people made the trip by plane, taking off from an improvised runway in a cornfield on the outskirts of Culiacan, the Sinaloan capital. Culiacan was a bustling city of slightly less than 700,000, not far from the Gulf of California, and was to the Mexican drug trade what the south side of Chicago was to Al Capone. For Guzman's organization, it served as both a business district and a stomping ground. Culiacan lay in close proximity to the busy ports in Mazatlan and Esquinapa. It was also a financial center of a sort, with abundant private companies, some of which were used to launder money. On its streets was everything that a narco trafficker needed: nightclubs, casinos, sports car dealerships, designer boutiques, cobblers selling ostrich skin boots, and beauty salons that, for a price, would encrust a girlfriend's fingernails in diamonds. The flight from Culiacan to Guzman's mountain bases was only 40 minutes, but those could be a harrowing 40 minutes. The local winds were treacherous, and journeys needed to be scheduled for early in the morning or late in the afternoon when they were low. Even then, passengers were often forced to crowd into the kingpin's planes with loads of supplies, sacks of rice or giant coolers of seafood, and with all that extra cargo weight, the pilots found it difficult at times to maintain proper altitude. Arriving at the compounds could be equally precarious. One of the kingpin's airstrips was carved into a cow patch. When it was not in use, the cattle were herded back in place to disguise it from the sky. Another, far more perilous, was built in the shape of a ski slope. It was hazardously short, and inbound aircraft came in hard on the steep upward incline in order to slow down. That was the runway Christian Rodriguez landed on just days after receiving Alex's call. The young technician had been terrified from more or less the moment he climbed aboard his plane, a rickety little Cessna that bounced around as it left the sprawl of Culiacan behind and passed above the highland peaks and valleys. Now, As he stepped out into a broad mountain clearing, he was greeted by the Kingpin's usual welcome crew, which couldn't have been any more consoling. Gunmen dressed in camouflage rolled up to meet him in a fleet of muddy ATVs. One of the soldiers, strapped like the rest with an AK-47, threw Rodriguez on the back of his vehicle and took off up a rutted dirt road. Terror was the commonest reaction to the mountains. The first time Jorge Cifuentes landed there in his own flimsy single-engine plane, he prayed aloud in panic. Another visitor, riding on the rough road from the airstrip, once saw a dead man hanging naked from a tree. A third was so unnerved by his stay in the Sierras that after flying back to Culiacan, he hurried into a church. Lighting two candles, he dropped down onto his knees. In a trip like this, he later told a friend, sometimes people don't come back. Alex was waiting up in camp. Greeting Rodriguez near a small wood shack, he let him in for a formal introduction. There was generally a protocol to meeting Chapo Guzman. Kisses, blessings, little fawning gifts. But perhaps unaware of the usual decorum, Rodriguez took a seat and launched into his pitch. Warming to his subject, he boldly proposed what amounted to a top-to-bottom upgrade of the Kingpin's communications. The rooftop satellites would have to go, he said, and in their place, he would bring in Wi-Fi by running cables from the biggest nearby city and extending the signal through a series of repeaters. Once this hardware was installed, he could connect the mountain compounds to the virtual private network he had built for the Cifuentes family. Opening his laptop, he demonstrated how all of it would work. Virtual private networks use normal public internet servers, but transmit data secretly through hidden tunnels accessible only to those who have a code. With this new setup, Rodriguez explained, Guzman would be able to send anonymous texts to anyone who was also on the network. The messages would not only be encrypted, they would be untraceable. Even if the Kingpin understood these suggestions, and it's not clear that he did, he seemed unimpressed. As an initial matter, he didn't want to merely join the Cifuentes family's system. He wanted one of his own. Moreover, he didn't like to type on his devices. Paranoid and more or less illiterate, he preferred to talk. He also hadn't heard much about his cherished cordless phones, which gave him a range of more than 2 miles. Despite his lack of technical expertise, Guzman had always been a shrewd consumer of technology. Over the years, he had availed himself of the best and latest from multi-channel walkie-talkies to state-of-the-art scrambling equipment. He had once spent more than $5 million on a counter-surveillance scanner that he thought might help him intercept the government's own communications. On occasion, he had even paid Mexican cell phone companies to scrub his private numbers from their files. Rodriguez's proposal did not seem up to his exacting standards, and he told the young Colombian to come back in a few more weeks to continue the discussion. Then, as abruptly as it started, the meeting came to an end. If he was being prudent, it was for good reason. Personal security. Guzman, distrustful to his core, tended to be wary of outsiders and strangers. That was for good reason, too. For the past 8 years, a succession of generals had chased him in the mountains, and while none so far had caught him, a few had gotten close. In his third year on the run, 2004, the Mexican army had managed to tap his satellite phone. 200 paratroopers swooped down on one of his hilltop ranches, missing him by minutes. The following year, pressing their campaign, the troops arrested his eldest son, Iván Archivaldo, in Jalisco, and then one of his brothers at a family celebration at a Chinese restaurant in Culiacan. In 2006, the latest commander on his tail, General Rolando Hidalgo Eddy, upped the ante further, planning an audacious raid on the rural estate that Guzman had built for his mother in La Tuna. Eddie had gotten word from an informant that the Kingpin would be visiting the villa, a red shingled mansion nestled in the hills that ringed the village. But when the soldiers stormed the house, Guzman was nowhere to be found. No matter how doggedly the military hunted him, however, Guzman had far less to fear from his foes in uniform than from his friends in the cartel. At the time of his meeting with Rodriguez, he was embroiled in three separate wars with three separate sets of old friends. The bloodiest and most personal war was with his oldest friends, the Beltran Leyva brothers. The brothers, Arturo, Hector, Carlos, and Alfredo, had been raised up the road from La Tuna in the nearby village of La Palma, and for many years, their lives had mirrored Guzman's. They, too, had started their careers as small-time poppy farmers and had, like Guzman, gone to work in their young adulthood for the Guadalajara drug cartel, the reigning power of the 80s. All of the men were connected by a clannish bond of loyalty. When Guzman was imprisoned for killing Cardinal Ocampo, the Beltran Leyvas sent him the cash he used to procure the lobsters and liquor that lessened his ordeal behind bars. After he escaped from prison, they joined his Federation of Regional Traffickers, serving as founding members of the Sinaloa cartel. The Beltran Leyvas supported their old friend in his early wars of conquest against his rivals on the border, the Gulf and Tijuana cartels. The family's youngest sibling, Alfredo, virile, brown-eyed, and fulsomely bearded, was especially close to Guzman, having married one of his cousins. The origins of cartel civil wars tend to be obscure, but Guzman's war with the Beltran Leyvas seems to have emerged partly out of ordinary business disputes and partly out of the kingpin's own acute anxieties over security. Throughout much of 2007, the two sides had been sparring over a lucrative distribution route in Chicago. Arturo Beltran Leyva, the family's leader, was also still seething over the painful losses he had suffered that year when nearly 20 tons of a joint share of cocaine, worth hundreds of millions of dollars, were seized by the American authorities from one of Mayo Zambada's merchant freighters. Heightening the pressure, Guzman had become displeased with the mounting control that Arturo and Alfredo were exercising in Acapulco, a profitable port town he wanted for himself. Then in late 2007, another new general, Noé Sandoval, began a tour in Culiacán and, like his predecessor Eddie, stepped up operations, closing airstrips, seizing small planes, and destroying pot and poppy fields. Up in the mountains, Guzman did not appreciate that Sandoval was harassing him, while down in Culiacán, the Beltran Leyvas were living the high life, carousing freely and conspicuously, turning up at lavish parties with famous singers and soap opera stars. The tensions broke into the open in January 2008, when Sandoval's troops, suddenly switching targets, went after and arrested Alfredo. Arturo, who was prone to fits of cocaine-fueled rage, immediately blamed the arrest on Guzman. Mayo Zambada, playing a familiar peacemaking role, convened a hasty summit, denying that his partner had tipped off the authorities. But a few months later, when Guzman's son Ivan was released from prison on a curious technicality, Arturo, already suspicious, decided that the fix was in. After that, the two men's friendship was, as Mayo's brother Rey Zambada put it, not as comfortable, if you will. Another one of Guzman's intimates, his chief of staff, Damaso López Núñez, had a slightly more pointed assessment of Arturo. No one could make him come to reason, he said. He decided to make war. Even for Mexico, the bloodshed, which began that April, was unprecedented. Violence ripped through Culiacán. In May alone, more than 100 people in the city lost their lives. Some were burned to death, some were beheaded, some were raked by gunfire while waiting for a traffic light to change. Among the dead was one of Guzman's sons. On May 8th, well after dark, Edgar Guzman López was coming out of the Forum shopping mall in Culiacán with a few of his friends when three SUVs screeched up in the parking lot, blinding them with headlights. The young men ran toward their own truck, a bulletproof Ford, but not before a dozen gunmen opened up on them. Even for a gangland hit, the killing was excessive. 500 rifle rounds were fired, and nearly 20 vehicles were damaged or destroyed. One of the killers had been armed with a bazooka. In the wake of Edgar's murder, a stone cross flanked by flowers and a legend reading, "We will always love you," sprung up in the middle of the shrapnel-strewn lot. Rumors swept through Culiacan that Guzman himself had come down from the mountains and was holed up in a stupor at a house he kept in town. For the funeral, it was said, he bought every rose in the city and blocked the streets around the mortuary where the young man's body lay so that he could grieve in private. Despite his savage narcissism, Guzman was profoundly connected to his family. Even in the frantic days after he escaped from prison, he had managed, at great personal risk, to visit his mother in La Tuna. But Edgar's death was particularly painful. He was only 22, a business student, and the father of a newborn baby girl. It was only a matter of time before Guzman took revenge. Still in mourning, he returned to the Sierras and sent out waves of kidnap teams with orders to find and lift high-value Beltran Leyva targets. One of the suspects was discovered within days. Alex Cifuentes was in the mountains when the man was flown up to one of Guzman's camps to face interrogation. The kingpin, solemn in a baseball cap, was waiting at the airstrip as the plane came down, sitting judge-like at a small white table in a clearing. The man was hauled in front of him, already bloodied by a beating. As the questions started, Alex looked away for a moment. When he turned back, the man's severed head was lying on the ground. Christian Rodriguez returned to the mountains in the new year. When he arrived in the Sierras, flying in from Medellin, then up from Culiacan in another small plane, he saw that Guzman had taken his advice. The internet cables and repeaters were in place, and the camp had high-speed Wi-Fi. The young technician had done his own work in the interim. Over the past few weeks, he had scrapped the idea of putting Guzman on the Cifuentes family's network and had instead devised a plan to connect a group of high-tech cell phones to a separate server network. Working in tandem, the phones and servers would give the kingpin exactly what he had asked for, the ability to talk in secret through the internet, not just to send encrypted texts. Rodriguez's new system was a triumph of complexity. The cell phones he planned to use, Nokia E71s, would transmit voice data back and forth through Guzman's high-speed Wi-Fi. The data would be guarded as it moved from phone to phone by three locked doors that could be opened only with a key code. One of the doors would protect the encrypted conversations as they left the phones, another as they reached the network's firewall, and a third as they passed through the central server, headed toward their final destinations. Most of the Nokias would, for ease of use, have three-digit speed dial numbers like desk extensions at a company. Mindful of the kingpin's complaints about his cordless phones, Rodriguez had sketched out plans for a digital adapter, permitting those devices to work on the system too. There would also be a second server, a trunk, he called it, attached to the central server. It would enable calls from the networked phones to those that were not directly connected to the network. If the basic structure was intricate, only an advanced engineer would understand its detailed working parts. SIP vendors, private branch exchanges, TLS encryption, which is why Rodriguez brought along a visual aid this time. Sitting in the shack again, he spread his flowchart on the table, mapping out the system for Guzman, Alex, and the head of their technical department, a heavyset man nicknamed El Gordo. Here, he pointed, was the server he was planning to build for the Nokia extensions, and here, as they could see, was the adapter for the cordless phones. Over here was the trunk he wanted to add, which would connect the Nokias to the rest of the world. Once again, he performed a demonstration, booting up his laptop and connecting his own phone to a prototype server in his office in Colombia. When the line was open, he placed a call to Dali Cifuentes, and passed the phone to Guzman. It was just a silly test. Hi, can you hear me? But the kingpin seemed to like it. There he was, in the middle of the mountains, talking to his friend through a computer. Approving the project this time, Guzman offered Rodriguez $100,000 on the spot to do the job. Half he would get now in cash, half would be sent to him in Medellin. With $50,000 in his luggage, Christian Rodriguez hurried home and got to work. In a matter of weeks, he had roughed out the network, and all that remained was to configure the extensions. When Alex Cifuentes called with a list of people Guzman wanted to have access to the system, Rodriguez began assigning speed dial numbers. The kingpin got 121. His eldest son, Ivan, got 129. Mayo Zambada was given 150. There were other people, too, and Rodriguez was familiar with many of them by now. Guzman's chief of staff, Damaso Lopez, 125. His lawyer, Oscar Gomez, 145. And his favorite ex-wife, Griselda Lopez, 132. Soon, however, the kingpin started calling to add more people to the list, some of whom were not familiar. There was Muchacha, 126, ING, 122, and someone named Raton, 135. Within about a month, the list had grown to nearly 70 names. Rodriguez needed help and was relieved when Alex's assistant offered to lend a hand. It was an oddity of Guzman's operation that the kingpin's private secretary had a small staff of his own. The assistant, Andrea Velez, had been on Alex's payroll for a year, but didn't seem like the rough-edged flunkies Rodriguez had encountered in the mountains. A Colombian, like he was, Andrea was stylish, cultured, and well-educated. She had gone to a prestigious Catholic girls' school in Colombia, then on to university, where she had obtained a psychology degree. As they worked together setting up the Nokias in a swimsuit shop that one of her girlfriends owned in Medellin, Andrea shared her story. Not all of it, of course. No one in the kingpin's inner circle spoke too openly, but just enough for Rodriguez to get a sense of how she had found her way into the same precarious universe that he had. Andrea had first met Alex a year ago, she said, after moving to Cancun. Before that, she had been living in Miami, but unable to find a job in the economic downturn after the American recession, she had taken a chance on Mexico, which had seemed like an adventure at the time. Andrea had a friend in Cancun, a Colombian actress named Angie San Clemente, and when Angie introduced her to her boyfriend Alex, Andrea recognized him as one of the Cifuentes, a wealthy family of Colombian entrepreneurs. Alex loved pretty women and quickly hit it off with his girlfriend's friend, offering her a job as his assistant. The job seemed glamorous and easy enough, and Andrea had accepted. It was all fairly normal for the first few months. Alex owned 4 or 5 apartments in the heart of Mexico City, and one of Andrea's earliest assignments was to spend his money filling them with art and Hermes furniture. When he decided to improve his look, Andrea took him shopping. Alex spent a good deal of time in the Mexican Sierras, and whenever he was up in the mountains, he often asked Andrea to send him little odds and ends, mostly outdoor gear from Bass Pro, his favorite camping shop. It was, she knew, somewhat curious that all of these transactions were in cash, and that every now and again, Alex had her drop by luxury hotels to pick up packages on his behalf. But at least in the beginning, it was only part-time, and she didn't really think about it much. Andrea had a day job, a good job, doing advance work for the well-known political consultant J.J. Rendon. On the side, she pursued her other passion, running a modeling agency. It was only when she was brought into the movie project that she finally understood what was going on. The project had been Angie's idea. As an actress, she knew scripts and had always wanted to make a film about Alex's famous boss. Several months earlier, she and Alex had pitched the boss on the idea and convinced him to hire a writer, someone from Colombia who Angie knew through the industry. The writer, Javier Rey, had started on a book, El Padrino, he was calling it, since that was how it worked. You had to have a property in hand before anyone would think about your screenplay. As Alex started to trust Andrea, he put her in charge of corresponding with Rey. Soon enough, she discovered who the book was about and who she had been working for in secret all along. But that, of course, was the one part of the story that Christian Rodriguez already knew. He had made his own discovery by that point. Life in Guzman's entourage was anything but normal. A few months after the encrypted cell phone system was in place, the kingpin summoned Rodriguez to another meeting in the mountains. Even by his own clandestine standards, the subject was exceptionally sensitive. When the young Colombian arrived, Guzman sat him down again with Alex and his tech chief El Gordo and asked him what he knew about spyware. Rodriguez knew enough to recommend a product called FlexiSpy, a commercial software designed to be uploaded onto cell phones and computers. As the three men watched, he opened the kingpin's laptop and logged on to FlexiSpy's website. Once you installed the program onto someone's phone, he said, the malware gave you access to everything they did. You could read their texts, see the records of the calls they made, obtain their GPS locations. FlexiSpy organized this data into handy spreadsheets that were automatically emailed once a day to the registrant's account. There was even a feature that made it possible, legally and with a click, to activate a cell phone's microphone remotely. That meant the kingpin, if he was interested, could eavesdrop in real time on the conversations of the people he was bugging. Guzman was interested. The sensitive part was who he wanted to bug. His wife, his ex-wives, and several of his girlfriends. He had always been preoccupied with what people said about him publicly, and even more with what they thought about him privately. From the earliest days of his career, he had wiretapped his lovers, friends, and enemies, and had long maintained a cabinet stocked with secret gadgets, little pens and calculators equipped with hidden transmitters. Even Alex, as devoted as he was, thought that he was paranoid, always probing everyone around him for signs of disloyalty and betrayal. The FlexiSpy was exactly what he wanted, and he told Rodriguez to get to work at once. They were ready within a matter of weeks. 8 or 9 BlackBerries infected with the FlexiSpy malware. Once the program was installed on the phones, Rodriguez completed the paperwork, setting up the usernames and registering the licenses. When the first of the accounts went live, Guzman disappeared for a while, poring over pages of his lover's texts and phone logs. It was bad enough at first that Alex and El Gordo started to joke that FlexiSpy had become his new toy. But to Rodriguez, the program must have seemed more like an obsession. Every day, sometimes more than once a day, the kingpin called to complain that the GPS on one of the bugged devices wasn't working, or that another had gone silent altogether. The spreadsheets of data, meanwhile, were becoming so voluminous that Guzman turned them over to one of El Gordo's subordinates on the tech team. The young man, Benjamin, was ordered to read through the reports each day and write up detailed summaries on anything suspicious. To be sure that no one knew what he was doing, Guzman instructed him to sit at his computer wearing headphones and pretend that he was listening to music. It only got worse. In the early months of 2009, Guzman approached Rodriguez again to ask if it was possible to intercept emails from an internet cafe. As they discussed the project further, it turned out what he really wanted was to intercept every email from every internet cafe in Culiacan. This was a preposterous request. There were hundreds of thousands of people in the city, and who knew how many internet cafes? It was also a mission without an explanation. Guzman rarely gave a reason for the duties he assigned. Rodriguez reached his breaking point that spring. One day, he was sitting in his quarters when a red alert rang out that the army was approaching. There were procedures for events like this, and at the sound of the alarm, the kingpin security detail hurried into action. The gunman and his personal guard grabbed their heavy weapons, and the two external rings established a perimeter and started to surveil the troops from posts along the roads. Amid the panic, Alex found Rodriguez and quickly hauled him toward the edge of camp. Guzman, dressed in camouflage, was already there receiving updates. As the field reports came in, he issued an order for everyone to move a little farther up the hillside. They would run if they had to, but until they had determined where the soldiers might be headed, it was safer, he advised, to remain in place and hope they simply passed. They all fled when the army came into the compound, slipping off in file down a narrow mountain path. That first afternoon, they walked until nightfall, sleeping in a small house in the woods, 20 of them bedded down together. On the second day, they walked again, stopping only to take shelter in a canyon out of sight of the helicopters hovering above them. When one of the gunmen caught Rodriguez staring at his weapon, a very large weapon, he bravely boasted it could shoot the helicopters straight out of the sky. But if he meant to be comforting, it had the opposite effect. Rodriguez was in pieces, worn down by the walking and rattled by the kingpin's crew of killers who were armed to the teeth with he didn't even know what. It didn't help that Guzman seemed oblivious to danger, hiking through the wildflower scrub in a trance of self-assurance. Alex kept the young man close, but by the third day, when they reached another house and were put on trucks for the long ride back to Culiacan, he was near the point of collapse. Rodriguez never returned to the mountains. Flying back to Colombia, he stayed in touch with El Gordo and his tech team at a distance, answering their questions by phone or email. As he settled back into life in Medellin, he found it difficult to keep the ordeal of the past year to himself. Not that there was anyone to talk to. While he might have confided in Andrea Vélez, she was still tied to Guzman's organization. Unable to contain himself, he turned to a friend, or rather an associate, a fellow resident of Medellin he had worked with in the past. The associate was one of those men who always seemed to attract new opportunities, and after he had listened to Rodriguez tell his story, he generously shared one with his friend. Something, he said, had come to his attention. A freelance project in New York, just the sort of thing that might prove easy and lucrative for someone of a technical bent. A Russian organization was looking for a communications system, something like the network that he had built for Guzman. The Russians didn't want a long-term relationship. They wanted a product at a reasonable price, no strings attached. If Rodriguez was interested, the associate could make the introduction. All he had to do was fly to New York and meet one of their men. After showing him the system, he could turn around and fly right back to Colombia, with, of course, a big bag of cash.